All right, very good. Good to see you. And I wanted to share just a couple of small anecdotes. We ended last week with our checklist talking a little bit about some of the risks around estate planning, and we gave you kind of an overview of some things you ought to be thinking about. And I had two or three really good comments in the lobby, and a couple of people said, I'm not eager to get the microphone and have everybody look at me and make the comment in the group, but I'll share a couple of those with you today. And I'll share one other thing. When I had that same topic in my own Sunday school class a couple of years ago, and we were talking about the fact that as 50-something folks, that was my Sunday school class's age, we said, you know, we need to be helping our parents as they kind of think through their estate planning, and then we need to be thinking about it from our own point of view. So it's kind of two dimensions. So I had one woman raise her hand, and we were just talking about this earlier. She raised her hand and said that one of her family members, relatives, a lady, had told all of the descendants, said, listen, when I pass away, you guys need to be very, very careful with the house and everything here. I've hidden money all over the house. There's money everywhere here. It's in books. It's behind things. So don't throw anything away. When I pass away, just very carefully go through my belongings. There's money everywhere here. You know, a lady probably had gone through the Depression and saw banks fail and made sure that she didn't ever go through a bank failure. You know, so that was pretty funny to me. But two of the comments from last week in between services, one person, remember we talked about that if you have a medical power of attorney, how important it is that you be kind of in close proximity to the person. Maybe it's a parent or a relative that you're kind of watching out for. And one person mentioned to me that his father had gotten in such poor health and had regular situations at the hospital that he carried the medical power of attorney in the glove compartment of his car because he was being called away from work and having to drive directly to the hospital and make decisions about his dad's health and needed that power of attorney that readily available. So that was an interesting little anecdote to kind of, you know, put in the back of your mind that that's how immediate some of these things can happen and how readily at hand you might want to have that document around. Another person told me a story that in their case, they made a decision, a couple of siblings made the decision that the parent needed might need long-term care, and they bought a long-term care insurance policy. And I think the way the story went, that maybe the person they were caring for couldn't afford the policy, and they may have even gone in a little bit to help. But anyway, that policy that I think he said was bought at the end of the 70 years, decade of life, ended up saving the family, really, in a lot of ways, saved the parents' estate and saved the two children because they weren't in a position to care for that loved one once that loved one became incapacitated. And he was just sharing that turned out to be a huge blessing in their family. So just a couple of anecdotes where, again, people not eager to, you know, have the whole floor, you know, looking at them as we were chatting. So wanted to share that with you today. Well, let's dive in here. We are nearing the end of our series. This is kind of where we've been. And where we're at today is a new topic called How Much is Enough? An Appropriate Lifestyle. And Greg, I don't think this is your home. I think maybe you're just down the street possibly from this home. And it really is somebody's home if you want to ask me between services. Oh, in the pool house. Okay, gotcha. Right, that's a good idea. Yeah, but if you ask me between services, I'll tell you who lives here. But I'm not gonna give this guy any more attention than he already deserves by telling you now. But anyway, there probably is a place where we can find how much is enough. So let's dive in. If you have your handout. In our 11th lesson here, it's interesting to me as I look back through all the things we've been over this summer, I believe Scripture may have more to say on this topic, as best I can tell, than any topic we've been on thus far. That's quite amazing, isn't it? That maybe even more so than giving, the Scripture may have more to say about this than almost anything we've chatted about. So let's read a couple of verses and let the Scripture really teach us this morning even more than we've been trying to do that. Ecclesiastes 5:10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. Luke 12:15. Then he said to them, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. In other words, his point is, even if you win the race and actually accumulate a lot of financial possessions, that still really isn't where life consists. That really isn't where satisfaction exists. And I want to give you just a quick note there at the bottom. I try to give this testimony to my students at BJ as they come through, and I'm an accounting teacher, most of you know that, so I have a lot of accounting majors coming through my classes, and I try to give this testimony. I don't know that I do it every semester, but I try to give this regularly, that one of the ways that greed really sneaked up on me in my 20s and 30s as I was in business full-time was it took a little different form than you might think of. In my case, and I don't think this is unique to me, is the reason I'm sharing the story, I think this is very we're all a little bit susceptible to this. When I was a student, I was very motivated by grades. I really wanted to be a good student, even in high school, and it was very, very competitive, and that's the way, and I'm not saying I was doing this really for the Lord, honestly. My heart was not right in a lot of these cases, and I'm not saying that I did it for the right reasons, but I was very competitive around grades, and in high school and college, that's how you keep score if you're doing well, is whether you make an A or not, right? Very simple. That's how you know if you're ahead of the guy beside you. Well, when I got into business and went to one of the big public accounting firms, what they call it, the big four firms nowadays, one of the things they introduced us to was the idea that I came in with an incoming class, they called us, of about 8 or 10 people. And right at the beginning, they made it clear that the incentive program that we've set up for you in this accounting firm is that at the end of the year, you're going to be ranked. You're going to get performance reviews, and you're going to be ranked, and somebody in this group of 8 or 10 is going to be ranked number one, and whoever's ranked number one is going to get the highest raise for next year. And then there's going to be a number two person and a number three, and then those people down at the bottom are going to eventually be counseled out of the firm. That was the phrase they used, counseled out, you know. And so anyway, there was this merit system. Well, I was in that system for 7.5 years, and taking that competitive spirit that I had in college, you can imagine what I did. I said, okay, here's our new scoring system. Here's our new scoreboard. We're going to measure ourselves by money. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to take the money home and put it in the bank and have a big bank account. That really didn't, there was nothing in that for me. And I didn't really drive a nice car. I didn't really wear anything fancy. None of that really mattered. What mattered was beating the guy beside me. What mattered was getting to the top of that group and having the highest raise as a measure of winning the competition. That's really what it became. Well, I left public accounting, went to one of my clients. And in corporate world, they don't do it exactly that way. In the corporate world, you're not in a group of people. But in that case, I was a VP, and so I was measured against other VPs and kind of in the executive team. And the way you measured it in that world was who got the biggest bonus. You know, who had the biggest bonus at the end of the year and who got stock options and who was in this program and that program. And so I carried that through, and I would say most of my 20s and 30s, I was highly motivated by money as a scoreboard, not so much money to accumulate things or to spend lavishly, but it was a scoreboard to keep track of how I was doing. So that was the trap that Satan got my leg in. And so, you know, I want to share that with you as a form of greed that maybe you hadn't thought about before. So a couple other thoughts here about this topic. Let's keep moving. Riches are temporary and uncertain. Look at Proverbs 11:28. He who trusts in his riches will fall. Proverbs 23:4-5, one of my favorites. Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. And, you know, there's just story after story about, you know, ball players and entertainers that have made millions and now they're bankrupt or now they're working in some menial job. You know, we've seen many, many examples of where the money, you go back and look and say, you know, I read about a ball player just this week. He made $31 million in his career and he was caught shoplifting about a year ago in September. And you're thinking, you got to be kidding me. The guy was shoplifting, a former NBA ball player, made $31 million in his career. He's that broke that he's shoplifting in an Apple store? I mean, you got to be kidding. But that's what Proverbs tells us. That's what happens to money. And you look back and think, well, does he own a home? I mean, is there anything tangible? Is there anything we can find in $31 million of career earnings? And it's like, well, no, not really. Just a sad commentary. All right, let's keep rolling. The Bible also tells us that money is a great servant but a terrible master, to quote Alcorn. Just a terrific quote from him. Luke 16:13, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Luke 18:22-23, one thing you still lack, talking to the guy we call the rich young ruler or whatever, one thing you still lack, sell all that you possess and distribute it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. But when he heard these things, he became very sad, for he was extremely rich. So there was a guy that as best we know, you know, chose eternal consequences rather than give up his riches. Look at number four, the admonition to be content. And let's read a couple of verses there. Proverbs 38:9. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I be not full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. So again, this idea of contentment. And let's read 1 Timothy. This is such a good passage, and I put it on your handout to make it easy for us to get to it this morning, not have to spend a lot of time searching searching through our Bible. 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10. This is the teaching about how much is enough. I mean, and I don't think I could do any more with this than what the Scripture itself is saying. I don't think we can add a lot to this. This is so well enunciated for us. But godliness, and in the chapter, if you go back and read it as I did this week, in the early part of that chapter, there was a debate going on about what godliness was. And so he pivots there in verse 6 and says, okay, in contrast to what we've been talking about, now let's change the topic a little bit. And he says, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we can take nothing out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But watch for this one. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. And then in verse 17 through 19, he's very clear with us that do have a lot of this world's goods, and frankly, that's all of us in the room, but you know, obviously some more than others. But instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. What a great phrase that is. You know, don't put your hope in something that's uncertain, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Remember, we talked about that from Ecclesiastes, that enjoyment of things is a separate gift from the things themselves, and that we want to pray for that gift of enjoyment, pray that we get something in the Lord's will, that He's going to provide that gift of enjoyment. And I would encourage you, I've prayed about this, even like buying another car or buying something around the house, like, Lord, if you don't want to accompany this with the gift of enjoyment, then I'd just soon not have it. I mean, I don't want it unless you want to bless it and give me that gift of enjoyment. All right, let's keep reading. So those of us in the room who are well-to-do, what should we be doing? And it's a nice little four-question scenario for you and me. Are we doing good with what we have? So that's a question. Are we doing good with it? Are we rich in good works? Are we generous? And are we ready to share, storing up for ourselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future? So that's our question. Are we doing those four things? I mean, is that really what we're doing with the wealth that we have? And then down at the bottom, again, kind of pivoting off of one of Mr. Berg's series there about whether God is enough, are we unwittingly, in the way we manage money or the way we acquire possessions, are we unwittingly maybe living as if God is not enough? Are we really saying to ourselves, I have to have something more in order to be content? So a very convicting thought there about that concept of contentment. Well, let me tell you a quick story about a guy. Some of you, I know older folks, we may have heard the story, but I want to tell it for the benefit of some of these that are younger. I want to tell you about a guy named Stanley Tam, and I'm going to kind of refer to a written part of his testimony. I've got a book, his life story. I'll show the book coming up, and I've read it and own it, but I don't want to spend the rest of the time telling you his story, which I'll be tempted to do if I get rolling on it, because it's a neat story, but I'll stay real disciplined and just kind of share this part of it with you. Stanley Tam was born just outside of San Francisco in 1915. When he was 9 years old, his family moved to a farm near Lima, Ohio. My parents were religious, moral people, and I was raised in church. We didn't smoke, drink, or swear, but we weren't really Christians. He came up through the Depression days and graduated from high school in 1933. I was selling door-to-door household items, tools, and things like that. One day, I knocked at a door, and a farmer's wife invited me in. For 2 hours, she talked about Jesus Christ. When I left that farmhouse, I was under deep conviction. I just couldn't get away from it. I was convinced she had the kind of spiritual reality I wanted. 6 weeks later, I went forward and accepted Christ at church. Raised in the Depression, Stanley had seen his parents agonize over the harsh financial famine that swept the country. And so he had an insatiable desire to succeed in business. And if you read the book, I'll digress a little, he really, really wanted to own his own business. He was a sales guy, but he really wanted to own his own business. In 1936, he started his own business with high expectations, but after a short time, it was losing money and he was out of cash. I decided to call it quits, and numb with disappointment, I packed my few belongings and headed home to Lima. Just outside of Columbus, an incredible thing happened. The Lord seemed to say to me, Stanley, do you have enough faith to turn your business over to me, to let me run it for you? And I told the Lord, take my business, Lord, and if you'll make it succeed, I'll honor you in every way I can, I promise. I had $25 to my name after returning home that day and was able to borrow another $12 from my dad. So with $37 and God as my partner, I started out again. Slowly but surely, the business began to turn a profit. Soon he felt the Lord asking him to give ownership of the business over to God. And this was interesting. It's an evolutionary thing, and again, I don't want to digress too much, but he literally felt the Lord wanted him to let the Lord be the owner of the business. So listen carefully. He said, it took some persistence to convince an attorney to help him with this unique request, but eventually papers were drawn up to turn over 51% of the stock of the company to a nonprofit foundation. So what he basically did was he started a foundation, earned the stock and all the profits of 51% over to the foundation, and in effect, the foundation became the majority owner of his company. However, the Lord didn't stop there. In 1955, he felt the Lord urging him to give the entire business to the Lord. So Stanley Tam obeyed, turning over all 100% of the stock and profits to his Heavenly Father via the nonprofit foundation. And what I find interesting about this, his great desire in life had always been to own his own business. That particular thing was real important. And in the end, that was what he ended up sacrificing and giving up, was the ownership of the business. And then he just became an employee and took a regular wage check like everybody else. And he says he also quadrupled the size of his plant. And some of you may have seen this. Anybody seen this building off of I-75? All right, good. You Ohio folks, very good. And he said he quadrupled the size of his plant. He turned the side of the building into a billboard for Christ facing Interstate 75. In gigantic letters, as you see, he said, created a sign that said, Christ is the answer. To date, the business that he built was called, it's called U.S. Plastics. And you might say, well, that seems kind of quaint. He's in the plastics business. Well, remember, back in the 1950s and 60s, that was like being in the iPhone business, right? I mean, that was the glamour area of the world. You know, nobody had seen plastic items built. You know, they'd made them out of metal and wood and iron and all that. And so that was kind of the incredible industry of that era. It has generated more than $140 million toward the work of the Lord. His story is told in this autobiography called God Owns My Business. So I really want you to hear that story. And you say, well, Jeff, I think it's pretty unlikely. And remember a couple of weeks ago, I've got these books back now that people borrowed. R.G. Letourneau, you know, he lived on 10% and gave 90%, and I'd be happy to loan these out again. I think they were a blessing to those that read them. You say, Jeff, I doubt if God is going to call me to you know, give up 100% ownership of my business or live on 10 and give 90. But what I like to do is I like to say to myself, okay, fine, if I compare myself to these kinds of pace setters, these kinds of guys that can really exercise faith in an enormous way like that, well, then why can't I exercise the faith to give a little bit more than I'm giving, or to give up that next level of home I could own and live in the one I have now? You know, why can't I do at least that much? If these guys can do that, why can't I do a little bit more than I'm doing now, right? So in other words, I'm not really calling you to necessarily do everything Stanley Tam did, but certainly we can do more than we're doing today. So let's talk about some practical realities, and these really are practical things. Proverbs, we've made it clear in several verses, like Proverbs, I don't know if I got the references, yeah, 15:6 and 21:20, we know that it tells us that there is some amount of savings in a wise household. In a wisely managed household, there is some level of savings. But we also know that Scripture warns us, when we were talking there about the wealthy farmer building the bigger barn in Luke 12:18-21, we're also told not to stockpile and not to think of just this world alone. So you say, well, how do I know what the difference is? If I had $50,000 in the bank, is that the right amount of savings, or am I hoarding and stockpiling and I should be giving it to the Lord? And I think your pastor may use this phrase because we've traded a couple of emails. I think that's just a wisdom decision. I think that's a wisdom decision that you have to get guidance from the Holy Spirit, and I think it'll be different for different people. You know, different people, there's going to be a different, you know, determination there about what is obedience for you, kind of managing between those two ditches on either side of the road, right? And you want to drive right down the middle of the road. So another thought for you is, and again, I've done this myself, is I've said, Lord, if I somehow get to the end of life and I have an estate that is larger than is really helpful for my children to have, And if I've kept money and it turned out I didn't go into nursing care and I didn't need, you know, some sort of long-term medical treatment, and I end up with more money than I should, then what I've done is fix it through my will to say, okay, well, let's just send it on to a Christian ministry, and if I've somehow misjudged this thing, we'll fix it as our last act on this earth, so to speak, our last financial act of stewardship. All right, let's look at another idea. Have you prayed about how much is enough? Look down there in letter C. One of the dangers in any sort of percentage methodology, and Burkett had these, and Ramsey's got them in the back of his books, one of the dangers in those of us that try to teach this idea of there's a budget percentage that's ideal for the amount of housing you have or amount of cars you have, that can get a little bit skewed if suddenly you get a huge raise at work or a huge promotion or your business takes off if you're self-employed, and suddenly you have way more than you really need. So there is some level where, even if the budgeted percentages would allow you to have a bigger car or house, that you just stop and say, I think, you know, at some point here, the Lord wants me to live at kind of this level of lifestyle. And again, that'll vary. And of course, we're warned there in 2 Corinthians not to compare ourselves with each other. You know, that we don't decide how much, you know, we should do based on what the Lord's instructed somebody else to do. You know, they may be living in a different home or driving a different car, but we have to search out the wisdom for ourselves. And I've reminded myself of this time, of this many times, is I've got my hands full just keeping myself straight. I have no energy left to try to keep everybody else straight. It's a big enough job just trying to make sure I'm doing the right thing. So I think that's good counsel for all of us. All right, one other one. Here's one. Look down in letter D there. One of the things, and years ago there was another guy back in Burkett's day, some of you may remember him, a guy named Ron Blue. How many of you remember that name? Everybody remember him? Okay, yeah, he was a good one too. As a matter of fact, I used to hand out a book that he had, and his book was called Master Your Money. And I used to hand that out a lot. As a matter of fact, it was kind of one I kept six or eight copies of, and I would just kind of give them away. And his point was, we want to make sure that we are the master of our money, not the other way around. And a couple of quotes, again, from going back to Dr. Berg and others have said this: are the things that we own tools or trophies? And boy, I'll tell you, that little phrase has really packed a real punch of conviction with me. I don't know about you, but that one has haunted me. That one has kind of, you know, like Ecclesiastes talks about goads and nails. That's somehow that one's gotten goaded into my consciousness. And the Lord has done a lot to turn some things that were going to be trophies for me into tools. You ever had that happen? You ever had something you thought was really nice, the Lord turns it into a tool for you to help you learn that lesson? I'll give you a couple of examples. These are very tried, but I think you'll recognize what I'm saying. A few years ago, I bought a little overnight suitcase. Not a big purchase by any means, but I was really proud of this thing because it was in that era where, you wanted to have a roller bag, but the airlines were getting real tough on you, and a lot of trips I took were only 1 or 2 day business trips, so I wanted a real good suitcase that would fit in that upper bin, right? We all have those now, right? Everybody's got suitcases that just barely fit in those upper bins. And so I went out and bought one, and I was pretty pleased with this little suitcase. It was one of the nicer ones I'd had, and I was using it quite a bit. And again, so was it a trophy or a tool? Well, we're going to find out, you know. So I'm using that. So my son comes along and says, Dad, you know, I've got to take a weekend business trip. How about I use that suitcase? You know, I don't have one that fits in the overhead bin. And I'm going, okay, it's my son. Okay, fine. You know, use my suitcase. Fine, it's fine. It's only a tool. Go ahead and take it. So he uses it, gives it back. And then we go along a little while longer, and my wife is trying to have a ministry with our neighbor. The lady is saved, the husband is not, and she's tried to have a ministry with him. And she says, well, Jeff, this lady's going to visit her parents up in New Jersey for the weekend. She needs a bag that'll fit in the overhead bin. And I'm going, man, I'm starting to hear a theme here. You know, I'm starting to, there's a lot of people that like this bag, you know. She said, Jeff, what do you think? Should we loan her your suitcase? I'm going, I guess so. Yeah, go ahead. You know, go ahead. I mean, I'm not saying I'm like totally spiritual about this. It's like, I get it, Lord. I get it. Yes, it's a tool. Yes, take it, you know. So we've loaned it out so many times. So now one of the zippers is kind of broken, and I'm saying, I know, Lord, it's just a tool. It's just a tool. It's fine, you know. And so anyway, that was just a little lesson the Lord gave me. And then another time I bought a car. This was for my older son at whatever that stage was where he was driving regularly. I don't know if it was probably in the early stages of college, somewhere along the way. But I bought a used car, and I bought it in the summertime, and it was about the third most I'd ever spent on a car. I wanted something reliable, and I was going to let all of my kids use it as they got through school, and it needed to be pretty reliable. So I'd spent a fair amount of money on this car, and we owned it that summer, and we're shuffling cars around, getting the kids where they needed to be. So partway through the summer, I had a friend of mine that he had done some things that were very helpful to me, And he came to me with this really odd request. And it was very odd, and I think it was of the Lord. He came to me and said, "Jeff, you know, my wife's going to be in town. She's got some, I think it was relatives or somebody she was visiting in North Carolina. And she was, anyway, it was a complicated story. But the net answer of the story was, Jeff, she really needs to borrow a car for a month. A month. She needs a car for a month, you know. And, of course, we've just bought this car. And I'm going, okay, Lord, I get it. Yeah, it's a tool. Okay, fine. You know, so I go ahead and loan that car. And I'm just saying to you, I just think the Lord is great at helping us turn our trophies into tools and reminding us that they really are just there to be used. And again, our pastor used to say about cars in particular that the minute you buy a car, you're in a race. It's in a race to get to the junkyard, and you're in a race to keep it out. So that's a pretty good way to think about cars anyway. And then, of course, you've seen this phrase before. We take money that we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't even like. You know, so yeah, I know you've heard that, but it's a good one, and I really like that one too. Okay, let me finish up with some quotes from this Alcorn book. And again, I've loaned a couple of those out, and I highly recommend it. You see the cover there. You can find it online very easily. But here's some quotes from him that came from the book, and it's just terrific thoughts for what we're talking about here today. Materialism is a failure to see that we were made for only one person and only one place. And boy, that's a powerful statement. And basically his comment is that greed is really idolatry. And if you believe that statement, and I think that's valid, then three of the Ten Commandments address idolatry / materialism. All right, here's another quote. More believers are destroyed by prosperity than by persecution. Again, no doubt that's true. Another one. Materialism is the mother of anxiety because treasures are temporary and uncertain. And I think that's a good point, too, that if you increase your wealth, you've increased your headaches. I heard somebody say one time that they bought an RV to go on the road, and he came back and said, "I think now what an RV is, it's an RV is a way to take your home repairs with you on the road instead of just leaving them behind." It's like, yeah, that's pretty good. That's probably about right. And then this is another quote from Alcorn. I love this one. This is right out of 1 Timothy 6, almost a verbatim quote right out of what we just read. "You have too much wealth if you are distracted from spiritual purposes or if you become proud and independent." I mean, that's almost lifted right out of the text we just read a minute ago. And then here's a good one for you. This is an analogy, and it's not unique to Alcorn. I know pastors have preached this. How much would you accumulate if you knew you were in a foreign country, maybe on an assignment, maybe you're assigned by the government, maybe you're an ambassador and you know you're going to be in this foreign country for, let's just make up a day, let's say 15 months, or you're on an assignment there by your company and you're going to be in France or Germany or someplace, you're going to be there for 18 months. Alcorn's point as he goes through that is, how much would you buy and accumulate in a 12 or 15 month visit in that foreign country? You know, you're probably in a rented place. You wouldn't go out and just buy loads of furniture and lots of cars. I mean, you would be thinking from the moment you got there, I've got to unwind all this when I go back home. So you'd buy relatively small things you could take with you, but you wouldn't just set up camp there like you're going to be there forever. And, of course, you know the analogy, and it's been preached many times. That's how we ought to look at this life, you know, that we really are just passing through. This really isn't our home. This really isn't our permanent residence. And so we should live as if, you know, we're going to divest ourselves of all this at the end and go live someplace else, you know, and we really ought to live that way. So, again, that's been preached a lot. I don't think that's unique and new to you. And then finally, your lifestyle is too large if you aren't giving consistently. So one final encouragement to you here at the very bottom is there's a website out there, and we'll turn it over now for some questions if you want to. There's a website out there, again, pointed to by the Alcorn book, and a lot of you have your phones, you have internet access, and you won't offend me. You can go ahead and look that website up if you want to, and I'll just leave it at that, globalrichlist.com. The gist of the website is to kind of find yourself on a little chart and find out how you rank in terms of the world's wealthiest people, and you'll find that we're all pretty wealthy, okay, if you go to that website. Okay, so we can do some Q&A.
All right, so especially I'm looking at the back of the handout. Thank you, Jeff. Mm-hmm. A little bit of a challenge for all of us, right? We want to have savings. That's a good thing. I know I want to have savings that if I get ill, if Nancy gets ill, to help me take care of her, for her to take care of me as we retire, as we get older. And yet the goal is not to stockpile wealth. And so I think, Jeff, this, I never thought of this. I guess this is maybe just my age. I haven't thought of it and don't have a lot of money. But that second point, capital B, was so helpful, just to guard against stockpiling. The idea that wanting to save money And yet it may be that maybe I don't have an extended illness, Nancy doesn't have an extended illness, and then you end up dying with more money than you want, right? And maybe thinking in a will to say, Lord, maybe each of the three kids or whatever get a certain amount, and over that everything goes into your work, everything goes to the gospel. And trying to find that balance between stockpiling and saving. So that was helpful for me.
Thank you, Jeff.
I appreciate that. Any questions specifically on this topic? You know, we should save for the future. We should be wise. But we don't want to be materialistic. We don't want to be guilty of stockpiling like that man always building a bigger barn. And I think this is so helpful. Questions, comments for Jeff related on the second page specifically. We can broaden it out after that if you'd like. But questions at all? Comments related to that? Being good savers, being good stewards, yet the goal is not to save everything we can.
You know, one thing I learned when I went back, and I really do encourage you to get that little Stanley Tam book. It's just a couple hundred pages. You can probably read it in one or two sittings. But the commonality that I didn't notice until this week between him and R.G. Letourneau was, and Stanley Tam lived maybe 10 or 20 years after Letourneau, but not too different, is that in both cases, the Lord didn't first work on their heart in terms of money. And as a pastor, you probably would see this coming a mile away. But he worked first on their heart about personal evangelism and then gave them both a burden for missions. And it was after getting a heart for personal evangelism and then missions, then he worked on their heart about money. It was an interesting sequence I had never seen. And it was true of both Letourneau and Stanley Tam. Very interesting that their heart was convicted first in these other areas, and then the money was the thing that followed after. The Lord didn't start by convicting them about their money. He started in these other areas. Kind of curious. Other thoughts on that? Anybody?
Questions on tools and trophies?
Am I the only one? Maybe I'm the only one that's ever had that trouble. Maybe you all know immediately that you buy things and they're there for the Lord's use. I don't know. Maybe I just betrayed myself.
Not original with me. I know a pastor helped me with this one. If your pickup truck is too nice to lend to someone, then you're driving too nice of a truck.
Wow.
Right? And just coming to the decision that my truck's available to help somebody move, to haul a washer, you know, to haul a dryer. I say that because I still remember, this was a long time ago and the person's not here, but the first time we were helping somebody move, you know, many of us have helped many of our brothers and sisters move. And I asked a brother, I said, hey, you got a truck, a bunch of us with trucks are helping somebody move, can you help? And he said to me with no hesitation, Greg, you don't put things in that truck. And that was just very clear. And I just went, wow. You know, so that will score one for a trophy on that one. Okay. But actually, you know, can the teens come into our house? No, because they might ruin something. You know, if we invite the teens over to watch the Super Bowl or something like that. You know, what's that a reminder of? Well, you know, again, these are things we should use for the Lord. And if they get a little bit of a stain or something, maybe that's okay,
yep.
Right? Anything related to that at all? Not a lot? Maybe some people are thinking, if I had any money in the bank, Greg, I'd be concerned about
it. Yeah,
but and that's okay.
Somebody wanted to know when we're going to do the lesson on how do you get money. I said, well, that's a bonus lesson. I don't know if it's going to be in the series or not.
Boy, just some real good practical things. I appreciate so much. Questions for Jeff? Comments related?
Our former pastor used to make the statement too. He got so tired of talking about his kids dirtying up the carpet in the living room. He said, I finally went out and looked for a color of carpet that was exactly the same color as the dirt in my front yard. And that way when they came in, it didn't matter, you know. Amen. I know how he feels.
This go ahead, David. Helpful. Go ahead.
Yes. With your organs and things, yeah. That's wonderful.
David, did you say that was on file at the church?
No, at the hospital.
At the hospital, okay, at the hospital, okay. Okay, interesting.
Gotcha. Yeah, so for the benefit of the recording, the idea is that some hospitals will let you put your contact information at the hospital itself of who your medical power of attorney is and who your living will decision maker is in terms of donating your organs, and that they'll keep that on file and help that way in an emergency they can track that person down quickly. Very nice. Good idea.
Questions for Any Jeff? Others? Comments? Alan.
Yeah, I don't love paying legal fees, but I'm a little nervous about trying to do a do-it-yourself will, for example, or whatever. I just think there's just enough going on there that, well, what if it wasn't witnessed properly? What if it didn't get filed at the courthouse correctly? I just think you might get a false sense of security. You might think, I've got a will and I'm good, and you're not really good. So, yeah, that's one of the – I think I would involve an attorney to some degree if you do a will. Yeah, I'd be a little hesitant to try to do it yourself. Well, it's funny, we were talking about that. I was talking to Pastor Greg earlier this week. I've been kind of searching throughout the summer. I knew that question may come up as we're chatting, and I've been talking to a lot of my friends, and I just cannot come up with a solid recommendation. I'm just getting kind of mixed results from a lot of different people out there in terms of how responsive are they, how accurate is their information, you know, are they keeping their fees reasonable? You know, because I wanted somebody kind of low cost I could refer you to. And I've really had a hard time. It almost makes me think some young guy, you know, with a five-year practice, if he wanted to go into estate planning, might have a real niche here. Because, boy, I'm really searching and not able to find a good one. So far, I haven't been able to.
Okay.